Well, that is the question, isn't it? Who are you? Last week, I introduced you to a real detective from California. His name is Jim Wallace. And Jim Wallace has had more of his cases featured on Dateline than any other detective. And he was a three-generation atheist. Only time he had exposure to religion is to hear criminals try and excuse their behavior because of Jesus or the Bible. So everything about his detective work was counter to believing in the Bible. And yet he decided, because his wife started going to church to save her from being in a cult, to disprove this newfound faith of hers by looking at the evidence the same way he would look at a case. And one of the cases we're going to look at today ends up applying to his journey in asking, who is Jesus? It's an actual case that was a cold case that he reopened. Let's begin with what happened, and we'll try and by the end of the day solve it. The case is that of Richard Matthews. Richard Matthews was recently diagnosed 20, 30 years ago with terminal cancer. His daughter, Cindy, found him dead in his recliner with a single gunshot under the chin. There was a 38 caliber handgun found on the floor nearby, and many people, including his neighbors, said he was discouraged because of the cancer diagnosis and thought maybe this is him taking things into his own hand. Jim Wallace and his team arrived. One of the first things they noticed, whether it was the front door, the side door, the back door, all the doors were locked from the inside. The scene was undisturbed. There was no immediate signs of forced entry or any other people involved. So as a detective, it looked like a classic scene of a suicide. And this case ended up staying cold for a while. In fact, it seemed solved. And yet he's going to come back to this case and realize that what happened in the room seemed to point to it was a suicide. But is there any evidence outside of the room or things in the room that said there had to be someone involved from outside the room? That's ultimately how this case got reopened when he found evidence for that. He applies the same thing to his journey into whether or not a real God exists. He likens this universe, this world, to that of a crime scene. He calls it God's crime scene. What can we deduce in the room, the world we live in, that might point to someone outside the room? And what is the quality of evidential tests we would need to even begin that process? By the time you see this video, he's become a follower of Jesus based on the evidence, but what was the process he went through, and how did he use his detective skills to do it? Let's watch.
First of all, is it possible that there are billions of Christians that are wrong? Yeah, of course it is. Let's have some humility about this. That's not the standard, though. I can't prove anything beyond a possible doubt. We don't try to do that because that's an unfair. There's nothing you could prove. You can't prove atheism beyond a possible doubt. We're looking for what's beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is a much smaller, shorter standard. And the gap between those two is filled with all of your unanswered questions. So I typically will say to people, and we do this in jury trials all the time, are you the kind of person who can render a verdict even though you may have some open, unanswered questions? And if someone says, yeah, I don't think I can do that, I think I'm going to have all my questions answered, well, then you're excused. There's no way I can put someone on a panel who can't make a decision with unanswered questions, because there's nothing you do for which you have every answer. Look, you're going to go to your door tomorrow and open the door with a key. Do you know how tumbler locks work? Of course you don't. You have no idea how that works. I got 1,000 unanswered questions before I even enter the house. But we do it anyway, because we know that you can actually operate in the world and make accurate, good decisions with less than perfect evidence. And there's no worldview for which you have perfect evidence, okay? Now, I will say this, the burden of proof, look, in the end, proof comes to whether we're trying to assess causes of certain phenomena. In other words, let's say I went to a crime scene and you're with me, you're my partner, we're working a homicide. We're standing on one side of the yellow tape and I look at those 10 pieces of evidence and I say, I think the girlfriend did it based on those 10 pieces. You look at the exact same 10 pieces of evidence and you go, I don't know, I think it's a coworker. Okay, well, you have a different cause than I have. I have a cause, the girlfriend. You have the cause, the coworker. We're looking at the exact same evidence. I have a burden to demonstrate to you why this evidence in this crime scene is best explained by the girlfriend. You have a burden of proof, though, too. Don't think you don't, to show me why you think. So as long as you have a different cause, So as I look at the universe, we live in a universe that has certain attributes. We're in a universe that has a beginning. It appears to be fine-tuned. Life comes into existence from non-life. It appears to be designed once it does appear. We have consciousness and free agency, and we think that some things are morally true objectively, whether we like them or not, and we even have a standard of righteousness that we compare things to and call it evil. There's eight features of the universe. I believe the best explanation for those eight features is a divine being who creates the universe from nothing because he's outside of space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. But if you think you can get those naturally, then your cause has to be nothing more than space, time, matter, physics, and chemistry. I have a burden to show you why I think God is the best explanation. But you have an equal burden because it's about cause. Because you think I can get the beginning of the universe from nothing more. You can't use space, time, matter, physics, or chemistry. Well, show me how you do that. That burden is yours. And for as many unanswered questions as I might have as a theist, you're going to have a lot more as an atheist.
All right, so he went pretty fast there in a lot of his arguments. I'm going to try and unpack those a little slower for us. And he wrote a whole book on this called God's Crime Scene, if you're interested in looking into that. I mentioned last week a book called Cold Case Christianity. These are just ways in which a detective has gone through the evidence. In this series, I said we're going to try and become detective combers. We comb through the evidence, right? That's what detectives do. And that word comber is going to stand for the things we learned in the series. Last week, we looked at circumstantial thinking. Why that's not bad evidence, it's a preponderance of evidence. This week, we're going to look at what it means to be open-minded. A detective might come to a case, have evidence around him, might even have a gut instinct. This looks a lot like what happened 2 years ago or 6 years ago. But you want to stay open-minded, not make predetermined conclusions about where the evidence is. How do we stay open-minded today? Then we'll look in a few more weeks how to have a basis for your claims. And then lastly, how do you determine eyewitness reliability? So let me give you a definition of open-mindedness and closed-mindedness. Closed-mindedness says, believe what you're told. Open-mindedness says, let the evidence unfold. And many of us grew up in systems that were very closed-minded. Some of those were religious systems. You should believe this because we're Catholic. You should believe this because we're Lutherans. You should believe this because, and you'd ask questions as a kid. I know we're Christians, but like, why do we believe that? And what's the evidence for that? We just believe it. You know, believe it because I said so. And you're probably left pretty unsatisfied by that. Just believe because you're told. Now, however, the same thing happens with atheism, right? You had a college professor. There's no intelligent design. There's no intelligent design? Believe what you're told. There's no evidence for intelligent design. There's no way to overcome the problem of evil with a good God. Really? Aren't there some people who've tried to think about this? No. Believe what you're told. So whether it's a religious system, an irreligious system, let's not be closed-minded. Let's be open to all the conversation. Let the evidence unfold. I have a friend of mine who's spoken here multiple times. His name's Josh McDowell. And when he was in college, he went through a journey from atheism. He thought Christians were idiots. He thought what they believed was idiotic, so he decided to try and disprove it. He ended up collecting all of his notes, and he wrote a book called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Then he kept collecting evidence. He wrote another book called New Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Really clever title, wasn't it? And it was really his journal entry of all the stuff he found that ultimately pushed him, nudged him over to becoming a believer in God and ultimately in Jesus and his death and resurrection. Well, his son grows up, now that he's a Christian. His son becomes 18, 24, somewhere in that range. He says, Dad, I don't know if I believe any of this stuff. His dad's like, awesome. Awesome. This is your chance to go on a journey to let the evidence unfold. It's not my faith. It can become your faith as you look at the evidence. And that's an open-minded approach, that the evidence is so strong we can follow it to its conclusion. So what are three things that detectives do that we could do? Well, number one, detectives are open to evidence outside of the room. Clues outside the room. You come to a crime scene and you're going to pick up evidence here, but some of that evidence might point to something that had to happen outside of the room to get it here. That's the metaphor he's using in that book, God's Crime Scene. So let me kind of lay out a little bit of the arguments. Each one could take, you know, a half hour. I'm going to give you about a minute or two on each one. So in his book, God's Crime Scene, he's saying as you observe the known world we're in today, it points to evidence outside of our universe that there must have been something outside. The first one he mentions is biogenesis. So if you notice in our world, life always comes from life. Right? You can't take a rock, electrocute it to death, and ever get a squirrel. You can't ever get a bacteria. We have tried for 200 years to create life with electricity and time and chemicals. Life always comes from life. So the question then is, if in the known universe what we can observe, life always comes from life, in fact, that term biogenesis comes from at least Louis Pasteur, when he kind of disproves spontaneous generation, throw rags in the corner, poof, out come mice. He's like, no. Actually, life always comes from life. All right, if we can observe that here in the room in our universe, then we say, then how did we get life? Life had to have a source that was alive. So one suggestion is that we originally came from a whole bunch of rocks and energy that exploded. Well, how did you get, though, from inorganic rocks to organic? You can't get from non-life to life. So there must have been a source of life. In fact, even Richard Dawkins, who's an atheist, believes in what's called panspermia. So panspermia is because we cannot make life from non-life in any conceivable way, something, pan, from the cosmos had to inseminate Earth with life, which is kind of a way of saying the aliens did it, right? There's some asteroid that brought the life, there's some alien that brought the life, but because we can't make life here, it had to come from out there. Okay, well, even Richard Dawkins is saying that something outside of the known universe we have seen had to create this because you can't get life from non-life. Secondly, think of cause-effect. We often say, what came first, the chicken or the egg? When you observe the crime scene of our world, you see that everything has a beginning, right? Chickens came from eggs, eggs came from chickens, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, even the first law of thermodynamics says, right, matter cannot be created or destroyed. And you're like, wait a second. If matter can't be created or destroyed, where'd all this matter and energy come from? Well, if in our closed system, matter and energy can't be created and destroyed, then something outside the system had to create it. Oh. And it must not be caused, right? Because if whatever that was had its own cause, then it would be the effect of something else. Whatever is uncaused is God. So I know I'm getting a little complicated, so let me bring it back down. So what we do is say, by what we observe in the world today, there must be something outside of our universe that was the source of life. Whatever it is in our cause-effect relationship, it had to be uncaused, and everything in our world is caused. So we need something outside of the cause-effect world to be there. Secondly, since our world is filled with a first law of thermodynamics, matter and energy can't be destroyed, something outside of the world had to create all the matter and energy we observe. Thirdly, complexity. When you see the complexity of the water table, the human eye, all the different details we see in our lives, every time we observe in our world information, it always came from a mind. Now, you might occasionally have a butterfly that has a pattern that looks like the letter A. But anytime you have actual information, paragraphs, thoughts, everything we observe in life is that it always comes from a mind. Yet we discover so much information in our DNA, so much information in science. If information always comes from a mind, then how would you get that out of just an explosion of energy and rock at the beginning of the universe? And lastly, where would you get immaterial law? Think of it this way. In order to have a big bang, it required a big banger, right? But where did the material come from originally to explode? Oh yeah, matter can't be created or destroyed. Where did the energy come from to make it explode? Even if you could solve those two questions, where did the universal laws come from, like gravity, inertia, strong and weak nuclear force? Where did those immaterial laws come from, right? You can't grab a handful of gravity, but you know it's true. Immaterial laws point to an immaterial lawgiver. That there must be a lawgiver that made these laws and structured rationality, must be rational, and he also must be immaterial, not substance, because we have so many immaterial laws. So that's a quick summary of his arguments of just some of the ways in which you start seeing whoever God is, he has to be outside of time and space, he has to be smart, he has to be intelligent, he has to have a mind, he has to be brilliant to have complexity, he must be the source of life, he must be immaterial, and he must be a lawgiver. Now, in case that was too complicated, we won't get more complicated than that. If someone was outside of time and space, what is something they could do? Well, they ought to be able to predict the future, right? If someone's outside of time and space, they should make future predictions and be right most of the time, if not all the time. Well, throughout the Bible, you have all these predictions that we have written down that we can look at long before they occurred. Predictions about Alexander the Great, predictions about all the major kingdoms of the world, predictions about Jesus' birth, resurrection. I talked a little bit about some of those last week. Let me just give you one that maybe you haven't heard before. I could literally give you 50 of them. There's a historian by the name of Josephus. He's a Jewish historian. He tells a story of what happens when the Persian king who took over Babylon came to visit there. And he tells the account of what occurred. Now, understand what happens in the story. I got to give you a little world history. So prior to the Persians being in control of the world, the Babylonians were in charge, and they had conquered Jerusalem. That's the people of God from the Bible. So let me show you on a timetable where we're at. We have books, manuscripts in the Bible from 700 BC, written by a guy named Isaiah. And it predicts 200 years in advance that the Persians would be in charge and the name of the Persian emperor would be Cyrus, 200 years in advance. Another person from the Bible, 100 years in advance, predicts that they would be conquered by Babylon, but for only 70 years. Those are pretty specific predictions. Well, what happens? Well, Josephus records that when Cyrus, king of Persia, world empire, comes into Babylon, Daniel's the prime minister at that time, he shows him a copy of the scripture from 200 years earlier and says, "Our God told us you were coming." This king doesn't even believe in their God. But here's what he says in Isaiah. So this is Isaiah from 700 BC talking to Cyrus. Here's some artifacts from Cyrus from 500 BC. Who says of Cyrus, got his name right, "He is the shepherd and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you will be built. You're going to come to power, you're going to help us rebuild our city that got destroyed by the Babylonians." Exactly what he does. "And to the temple which has been destroyed, your foundation will be laid." And Cyrus not only did it, he funded it. However, 100 years before, Jeremiah had said, "After 70 years are completed in Babylon, I will visit you and cause you to return to this place." Well, sure enough, it's been 70 years of Babylonian rule when the Persians take over, exactly as predicted. Now we're starting to see evidence of a who's outside of time and space, and there's literally thousands of these predictions of world history. Now Cyrus gets replaced by a guy named Darius. He's a king of the emperor, and another Bible book is written during his time, and this one's written by a guy named Nehemiah, and he's reflecting on this idea of God. He says, "You alone are the Lord. When I look at all the evidence here, you have made heaven, the heaven of heavens and all their hosts, the earth and everything in it, the sea and all that is in them. You preserve them all. The host of heaven worships you." He's like, when I just see all the evidence around me, I just know there's a God and I know it's you. To which you might say, well, a lot of people look at the evidence and say that there is no God. It's what the Russians did when they first went to space. If you remember the story, it goes way back in history. But when the Russians got back from space, they came back and said, "We looked around, there is no God." They made giant posters all over Russia, "No God. We looked around, no evidence for God. We're right, Americans are wrong." But we just recently sent a team of American astronauts around the moon. Maybe you followed the story. So one of the pilots, or the pilot, Pilot Victor Glover, is not only a scientist and an astronaut, he's a devoted follower of Jesus. Right, so clearly there's not a division between science and the Bible. The guy who just piloted the moonshot believes in Jesus' death and resurrection. And here's what he said. "As we get close to the nearest point to the moon and the farthest point from Earth, as we continue to unlock the mysteries of the cosmos, I would like to remind you of one of the most important mysteries there on Earth, and that's love. Christ said in response to what was the greatest commandment, that it was to love God with all that you are." This top scientist recently has said, "I believe in Jesus." And he talks a lot more than that, but this was his public broadcast. Now, the commander of the mission is not particularly religious. And look what he says happened when he got back from seeing the evidence of the moon. He said, "I got back on the ship, and I'm not really a religious person. But there was just no other avenue for me to explain anything or to experience anything. So I asked for a chaplain on the Navy ship to just come visit for a minute. When that man walked in, I'd never met him before in my life. I saw the cross on his collar, and I just broke down into tears." A scientist. Having not only an empirical experience, but an existential experience. He's closer to the evidence than you and I will ever be. And he said, "When I'm out there in space, seeing nature at that level, seeing the cosmos at that level, something drew me that there's something bigger than me. And I didn't come in with preconceived ideas." So number one, detectives We're looking for evidence outside the room, the clues of that. There's lots of clues. Secondly, detectives investigate the mystery of history. Nehemiah goes on to say, when I think about the fact that I'm now in the land that got taken from us 70 years ago, when I think of all the way you fulfilled your promises, I just think back of this pattern in history that you predict things and they come true. You are the Lord God who chose Abram. Abraham was the great, 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 great descendants of all the Israelites. You brought him out of his home area, Ur, of the Chaldeans, that's just kind of where he's from, and you gave him the name Abraham. And you gave him some promises, and one that we'd have this land, and we'd one day build a temple here. When it all got destroyed, we're like, well, there goes that idea. But you told us we'd come back. Now think about history. Have you ever heard of a nation that's been obliterated from their homeland and got their nation back? Once? How about twice? How about multiple times? The Israelites, Abraham's descendants, the Egyptians tried to fully enslave them, Hittites, a bunch of other ites that you don't want to go into, some more famous ones, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, all obliterated them, ripped them from their homeland, and yet God kept bringing them back. And then, of course, the Germans. And yet today, what do you look at? Israelites in that land, in that place, just as God predicted and said. That's a heck of an improbability to keep happening. That's actually what a famous mathematician and the guy who invented probability theory, a guy named Blaise Pascal, found. He wrote this book. The book is called Pensées, just means thoughts. Pensées on Religion. Blaise Pascal invented the modern calculator. He did a lot of work on vacuums and how vacuum work, and he invented what we know as probability theory. And he realized that most people, his fellow college professors, wouldn't even look at the evidence. He made what's called Pascal's wager. He said, guys, if I'm right, there's a huge benefit. If you're wrong, there's a huge downside. At least look at the evidence. And one of the things he writes about in Pensées is that when he looks at the Jewish people and how throughout history, despite severe persecution, severe displacement, they kept coming back to the things God promised, he's like, I can't ignore that evidence. As a person who invented probability theory, this is highly improbable when I look at the mystery of history. You ever thought about that? Detectives also examine the possibility that good came from God. Where did we get the sense of goodness that we judge ourselves by or other people? When you hear your kids say, life's not fair, where do they get the idea it's supposed to be fair? When somebody cuts between you in line, you say, that's not right. You're appealing to some standard you assume they know. Where did we get that good standard? And that good standard, if it's above culture, if it's above time and space, it had to come from something outside of culture, time and space. C.S. Lewis was an atheist, professor at Oxford, and this is really what started to move him toward deism. He said, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing the universe with when I called it unjust? Yeah, where did that standard come from? Now, Nehemiah, who wrote that passage earlier, says something similar. He says, God, you see the evil in the world. You saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt. We got enslaved for 400 years, our people did. You saw that. You condemned that. You heard their cry by the Red Sea. You showed signs and wonders against Pharaoh. You came against that. Do you believe that slavery is inherently wrong? Okay, why do you believe that? Because it's a best practice? Because it's a good idea? Or is it actually evil? Absolutely evil. Do human beings have eternal value? What would you root that in? Where would you get that standard? Well, the Bible says that standard comes outside of culture, right? Even the trials against the Germans, what was it about? It doesn't matter if you grew up in a culture that tells you owning people is right. It doesn't matter if you grew up in a culture that says it's okay to kill people. Even if your culture tells you there is a standard over the culture, outside of the culture by which we can evaluate wrongdoing. Well, if that's true, then that's another hint that what's in the room, a standard we appeal to outside of culture and time, is something that came from outside the room. And if that's true, that standard had to be good. To which you might say, yeah, Chip, what about all the evil in the world? Well, if I said to you, there's no such thing as a barber because I see all the bad hairdos. You say, well, no, just because you have bad hairdos doesn't mean there's not a barber. It just means they need some barbering. Or let me flip the argument. If I said, clearly there's no such thing as evil because of all the good in the world. Right? And I tell you my wonderful story about when my kids were born. I tell you a wonderful story about walking down the aisle. I see my wife walk down the aisle. I tell wonderful stories, my favorite memories, all these good stories. Does that mean there's not just such thing as evil in the world? There's no serial killers? Of course not. Well, in the same way evil doesn't negate God, it says we need more God over there. There's some absence of God there. And don't take my word for it. You know who says this better than anyone? The two greatest abolitionists in human history. Martin Luther King Jr., in his letter to an Alabama jail, and William Wilberforce, who pretty much outlawed all of slavery in England and the English Empire. And you know what both of them said? They said the standard that human beings are inherently valuable came from the Bible and the God of the Bible. If you've never read the letter from the Alabama jail, Martin Luther King Jr. says, there are laws in society, but they must square with the just law of God, a law that's outside of culture. And so when even America had some laws that were not square with the greater law of God. You say, well, I thought the Bible endorsed slavery. Well, listen, I could get into all the details, but here's the two greatest abolitionists in history, and they say the Bible is their source of abolition. I'll go with them, and I can explain any of the details on the other ones anytime you want. But these are Christians. William Wilberforce eventually became a Christian. He owned slaves before he got face-to-face with God and his message in the Bible. Last week, I introduced you to Tom Holland. Tom Holland was is a expert in Roman history, and he said, the thing that struck me is the things we love in Western civilization, compassion, care, love, treating people well. He goes, all that was foreign to the Roman ethic. What we take for granted as common sense was not common at all. He says, the measure of progress in the West is nothing less than the extent to which it has forgotten its debt to Christianity. All the things we think are inherently good, a Roman would have laughed at you if you would have said that. But something happened around 30 AD that began to spread this brand new ethic of goodness and caring for people and even seeing your enemies as inherently valuable. New ethic of just war, a new ethic of kindness, hospitals, orphanages, and it all began to spread somewhere around 30 AD. Give you one more. There's a guy who just wrote a book in the last year. His name's William Murray. And the book is called Taking Religion Seriously. And here's what he says about his journey as he began to look into this stuff. He says, I spent decades dismissing religion as superstition. But the more I learned, the less my own certainty made sense. Millions are like me when it comes to religion, well-educated and successful people for whom religion has been irrelevant. I started taking religion seriously by doing a lot of reading. But I was very, very empirical. And what happened? Well, he says he began to be nudged toward faith. Here's what he says. Next slide. I was moved and nudged toward belief, not by leaps of faith, but by encountering empirical information, which made me rethink my positions. And he outlines maybe the same things that our detective did. Complexity of life, fine-tuning of the universe, objective moral law we just talked about, and consciousness. How did we get consciousness except from a source of life? So let's look at our evidence. What are the pieces that we've looked at so far? And let's try and unpack them together. All right, so let's put all the pieces we've talked about here. How would we connect the dots this morning if we're going to try and examine, be open-minded, and investigate, and let the evidence unfold? Well, we have an intellect in our day, not a Christian, says, I never really looked into it. I decided to look into it. The very thing that they didn't do when Pascal, an incredible mind, brilliant mathematician, told his friends to do it. He tells us to look at history. Look at these improbable things that kept happening, predictions that got made. He also mentions that that it's at least worth taking the time to investigate it, because the pros are high and being wrong, the downside is high as well. All right? We have a Jewish historian that gives us multiple examples. I'll only give you one today, of specific times that a foreign leader of a different nation comes in and hears a prediction made about them with this level of detail. We have a source of good. The two greatest abolitionists who's ever lived said the God of the Bible is that source of goodness, and why we can know that we are all the same family, that we're all inherently valuable no matter what culture or time or space we're in. There's a source of good. That is validated by what? A agnostic at best, historian of Rome, who says the ethic you and I know is good started sometime in history around 33 AD. It began to spread the way it did. What would have caused that? These are the same arguments then made by our detective in his argument from God's crime scene, giving evidence of specific things, one of which I mentioned was that there's actual evidence of actual predictions made, not in the Bible, but in world history, of things written down in the Bible in that level of detail. Existentially, we have an agnostic who went closer to the moon than you and I will ever be. Maybe SpaceX will get it in, who knows? But probably closer than we'll ever be. And he said, being out there, I just sensed existentially there was something beyond myself. And science and the Bible cannot be in conflict. The guy who just piloted the moon is a deeply committed follower of Jesus Christ. So I would encourage you, it can be so much fun to learn this stuff. I know that first part was a little heady, and I tried to give you a compact version of it. There's ways to get into this in the low end of the pool and the deep end of the pool. But if you ever grew up hearing, just believe what you're told, there's no evidence, please dig deeper. There's evidence that something happened outside of the room. Speaking of that, how did Jim Wallace solve that case? Well, they thought it was a suicide, right? Richard had terminal cancer, dead in his recliner, he had been shot. Shot with a .38 handgun, it's sitting there by the side, and the doors were all locked on all sides with no seemingly outside evidence. However, they reopened the case, and they looked back at the case, and they found a very small piece of mud on the hardwood floor. It did not match any of the victim's shoes or anything they could find anywhere in the house. How did mud, with no other source, end up on the hardwood floor? Well, they found that that mud did match a boot print that was found in the front yard and a boot print found on the curb outside. Same mud. How did that get? There's now evidence something happened outside the room, in the room, that pointed to something outside the room. They also found that same gun, that .38, they found an unfired .38 caliber bullet on the street outside. How does a man who commits suicide get a chance to throw an extra bullet outside? They found the gun did not belong to Richard, and his daughter said he's never owned a handgun. They did an examination of the wound location and the body position. They were inconsistent with a right-handed man shooting himself. In fact, when they looked at the probabilities, what they found is that a right-handed man has a 90% chance of using a dominant right hand for a self-inflicted gunshot. The wound under the chin was inconsistent with a right-handed man, and the gun was found on the wrong side of the body for a right-handed man who'd killed himself. The position does not match the typical self-inflicted pattern. Therefore, the case got reopened. It was no longer a suicide, it was a homicide. Why? Because there's evidence in the room that pointed to something that had to happen outside the room. And that is the same process that Jim went through in deducing that there might be a God. And I'd encourage you to do the same thing. Maybe you're not sure who God is or what it means for him to be involved in human affairs, and I get that. Maybe you got a lot of bad answers growing up or people didn't encourage that. At Horizon, we're yours to explore. And we encourage you to investigate the what and the why to lead to the who. What do Christians believe? Why do you believe that? Is there any evidence for that? These are great questions to investigate. And if you ask for the what and you ask for the why, it might lead to the who. What kind of a God would do that? What does it say about God who actually allows slavery, that's frustrating, but condemns slavery? tells people that every single person is made in God's image. What kind of a culture would we have if we all treat each other with that kind of value? If there really is a God, a who's a source of life and goodness and complexity and wonder, and he made you, in the same way that when you make something, it's got a purpose, and you put a lot of yourself into it, what would it be like if there was a who made you to be a who with a purpose? And how would you find that purpose? If there's a God who works in human affairs, in a mysterious way, no doubt, that keeps his promises, what would it look like in your life to have someone you knew you could count on to keep their promises when you face difficulty or challenges? And if there's lots of historic predictions made about a Messiah, a king sent from God, like he's being born in Bethlehem, written about 400 BC, he's going to be crucified, he's going to be pierced, he's going to be denied by 30 pieces of silver, which we just studied in the last service, written at 400 BC. That's a lot of improbabilities. In fact, when Jim was on this journey, he started attending a church in California, by a church called Saddleback Church, where the pastor is Rick Warren. And Rick Warren wrote a book called The Purpose-Driven Life. It's not really an evidence-based book. It's more of a what do Christians believe, why do we believe it, and why would it matter to you book. And if you've never been through that book, it's probably one of the best sellers in the last 50 years in America and the world, I'd encourage you to pick it up. If you don't want a whole bunch of evidence, you just want to know if this who is who he says he is, what's my purpose? Or if you'd like to go through that book, we take people through that book all the time here at Horizon. Couples go through it, individuals go through it. This is one of the books that helped Jim discover what Christians believe, why they believe it, and who is God if it's really true. I'll invite the band to come out and do another Who song, because we're doing all Who music for the next 5 weeks. And when you think about this metaphor he used, right, the metaphor was looking out into the cosmos. And last week, Kenny ripped that song of Don't Get Fooled Again, right? We don't want you to get fooled by religion. We don't want you to get fooled by irreligion. We don't want you to get fooled by Christianity if it's not true. We don't want you to be fooled by atheism if it's not true. We don't want you to be deceived. The Bible says look deep into the microscope. The deeper you get, the more evidence you find. Look for miles. Which song are we doing? And miles out into the universe. And the farther you look into the cosmos, you start seeing immaterial laws. Math is true on the moon, and it's true here. It's absolute. They're immaterial laws of gravity and inertia and strong and weak nuclear force. And immaterial things like integrity and love and honor that all point back to a good God that encourages us to not be deceived, but to see him for miles and miles and miles.